Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the candidates in debate. Shimon Peres mourned a deadly train crash in New Jersey. Monday night, first debate, Clinton and Trump clashed over lots, including ISIS.
Well, at least I have a plan to fight ISIS.
No, you're telling the enemy everything you want to do.
No, we're not.
See, you're telling the enemy everything you want to do.
President Obama remembered long time Israeli leader and peace advocate Shimon Peres. He said he was there to bid farewell to his friend.
Who showed us that justice and hope are at the heart of the Zionist idea.
And tragedy in Hoboken, New Jersey, where a commuter train smashed into the station, killing one, injuring more than 100.
I have heavy structural damage. I have people trapped on the train. Major casualties.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Beth Reinhart, Michael Crowley, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Who's got the momentum for the White House with 5 weeks now and change to go? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Beth Reinhart, political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Beth, it's great to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks.
And from Washington, Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Great to have you back, Michael.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be back.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Michael, and Beth.
Beth Reinhart, how do you calculate a bottom line out of this week, starting with the debates on Monday night and then all the fallout that we've seen since then? We've got almost 5.5 weeks, not much more than that to go at this point. Where's the bottom line in the presidential race right now?
Well, it's, 39 days to go, and we're 4 days away from the debate, and we're still talking about this former Miss Universe, Alicia Machado, that Donald Trump, when he was the head of the pageant 20 years ago, ridiculed for gaining weight. And Hillary Clinton brought her up in the debate on Monday, caught Donald Trump flat-footed, and he's been on the defensive ever since. He was on the defensive throughout most of the debate, but that issue in particular has lingered. And we all woke up this morning to see that he had been tweeting at 3 a.m. About this former beauty queen, calling her disgusting. And so, whereas most candidates want to move away from a story like this, that even people in their own party are saying isn't reflecting well, Donald Trump digs in. That's the way he does it. And, you know, this, like a couple other examples we've seen where he has gone after an individual as opposed to a group, as he did with the Mexican-American judge that was overseeing the Trump University lawsuit, the Muslim father of the soldier, mm-hmm. Mr. Khan, who spoke at the Democratic Convention. These come across as very personal attacks, and it's not. People are, I think, are not thinking about the good points he made at the top of the debate about trade and about Clinton's, portraying her as sort of a figure of the past. I think there's agreement that he was pretty strong at the beginning of the debate. And I saw him this week in several rallies where he did make that strong case. But by continuing to bring up this this woman, Alicia Machado, it tends to cast a shadow over the, I think, broader and more persuasive arguments for his campaign.
Let's start with the portion where he was judged strong on many counts. This was Monday night, Trump attacking Clinton on her past support of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal.
You called it the gold standard of trade deals. You said it's the finest deal you've ever seen.
No.
And then you heard what I said about it, and all of a sudden you were against it.
Well, Donald, I know you live in your own reality, but that is not the facts. The facts are, I did say, I hoped it would be a good deal, but when it was negotiated, which I was not responsible for, I concluded it wasn't. I wrote about that.
So is it President Obama's fault?
And he went after her saying, look, 30 years you've been in politics, and is the country where it ought to be? And that was hard to answer. Later on, though, he went after her stamina, he said. She complained that he had talked about her looks. Hillary Clinton responded with this, noting that Donald Trump had called women pigs, slobs, dogs, and went on to talk about, as Beth says, Trump's treatment of a woman who was crowned Miss Universe in 1996.
One of the worst things he said was about a woman in a beauty contest. He loves beauty contests, supporting them and hanging around them. And he called this woman Miss Piggy. Then he called her Miss Housekeeping because she was Latina. Donald, she has a name.
Where did you find
her? Her name is Alicia Machado.
Where did you find
her? And she has become a U.S. citizen, and you can bet she's going to vote this November.
Okay, good.
But that was not the end of it. Donald Trump talking about it a lot throughout the rest of the week, tweeting about it, even very early this morning, late last night, talking about sex tapes of hers that were not exactly sex tapes. They were just grainy film from a TV show that she was in Spain, I think. Jack Meadey, what is this? Not letting this one go. I mean, surely Mr. Trump has more important things to do than talking about a former Miss Universe.
He sure does. I think the Arizona Republic, for the first time in 100 years, endorsed a Democrat. They made a point relevant to this. They write, Trump's long history of objectifying women and his demeaning comments about women during the campaign are not just good old boy gaffes. They are evidence of deep character flaws. I think that's the sense that we have here, a deep character flaw. One of them, obviously, is objectifying women. The other is being unable to take even the slightest criticism. It's like the grain of sand that gets inside the clam, and he just can't get it out. I mean, his wounded narcissism about these things. And imagine what this would be like in a president. There would be, how many times would he emerge from the White House at 3 o'clock in the morning sending out tweets about people who got under his skin? The skin is diaphanously thin.
I want to look at some more newspaper positions that came out this week on the candidates. It's a very interesting week in that regard. But this, if it's thin skin, Michael Crowley, there was a moment in the debate, it was an interesting moment, when Hillary Clinton kind of turned to the camera and spoke, yes, to the American people. That's who was watching, first of all, but also to the world. That's your beat, Michael. And she looked to reassure American allies that she would take peace and diplomacy, the presidency, international relations seriously.
Words matter when you run for president, and they really matter when you are president. And I want to reassure our allies in Japan and South Korea and elsewhere that we have mutual defense treaties and we will honor them. It is essential that America's word be good.
Michael Crowley, was she just trying to throw shade on Donald Trump there, or is there real concern out in the world about America's word under a potential Trump presidency?
I think there's definite concern. There's concern about what it means even if Donald Trump isn't elected. Some of these U.S. allies are wondering, is he speaking for some large portion of your country, or is he at least making an argument that people hadn't been hearing and
when
they're
nodding
their
heads? When he says what, Michael? When he says what?
When he says, for instance, when he criticizes the NATO alliance, suggests that because some members are not paying the amount of money into the NATO budget that they have pledged to do, and there are 28 members of NATO, our European alliance formed during the Cold War, he suggests that if a country has not paid what he calls its fair share, we might not come to their defense under Article 5 of the NATO Treaty, which guarantees that we will come to the assistance of a NATO member that is attacked. And this is just, that was a completely unprecedented thing for a mainstream politician to say. I mean, in the national security establishment, it was just like almost surreal. No one on a big political stage had made such a suggestion. And you know, that reverberated in all kinds of ways, not within NATO, but to U.S. allies around the world. And it's not the only thing like that, he said. He suggested, for instance, America might withdraw troops and nuclear protection from Asia, that maybe Japan should go ahead, South Korea develop their own nuclear weapons. You know, why can't they defend themselves? We're spending so much money to do this, they can take care of themselves. So it's really rattled our allies. And last point, Tom, I think at the same time, what I saw there was Hillary sort of auditioning a little bit to be president, talking like a president, right? Talking directly to our allies, sounding like the experienced foreign policy veteran that she became as Secretary of State. And I think, she wore that pretty well. It's not something Donald Trump has ever done.
Beth Reinhart, where would you describe this campaign race as standing, this contest right now? Here we are. It is the end of September. Where does it stand?
Well, I think the race continues to surprise us in that it is as close as it is, despite, you know, Hillary Clinton's long record of experience, her superior campaign organization in terms of, you know, the staffing on the ground and she's way outpaced Donald Trump on the airwaves. It's a competitive race. So I think that, you know, that speaks to Donald Trump's appeal, and it also speaks to the strong reservations that a lot of people have about Hillary Clinton. You know, there's obviously this insatiable appetite for change that helped propel Donald Trump to the Republican nomination, fueled Bernie Sanders' very unexpected and strong challenge to Mrs. Clinton. And so she's still got a lot of work to do to close the deal.
Jack, how do you read that? All the resources she has at her fingertips. And, of course, he has his own, but she's raised a lot of money. And she's got this record of, elected office. And still, this is a close race, Jack. How do you figure it?
Yeah, she asked rhetorically the other day, why aren't I beating him by 50 points or something?
And she's not anything like it. Why not?
Nothing like it. A piece today, Ohio is pretty much gone for her now. Ohio, without which no Republican has been elected president. You know, I think one of the reasons is just Clinton fatigue. And I think, people say that was yesterday. Even Trump's ads show clips of the Clintons in the 90s. That was yesterday, he says. I'm tomorrow.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. The first debate, Monday night. Trump and Miss Universe, of all things we're talking about 5 weeks before the election. Hillary and millennials. She does not have them fully in her camp. Aleppo bleeds, that terrible train crash in Hoboken, and Israel Shimon Peres is dead. Peace champion for decades there. Michael Crowley is with us, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Beth Reinhart is here, political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Our own Jack Beatty is here, and you can join us. What do you see at this point in the presidential race? Does it matter to you when all kinds of newspaper endorsements going against Donald Trump this week? USA Today, Chicago Tribune, which never does that to a Republican. Arizona Republic hasn't done it in 100-plus years and more. We'll look at those the day after the debate on CBS This Morning. Republican Vice Presidential Candidate Mike Pence explained why he thought his running mate Donald Trump did a good job in that debate.
What really happened last night was this difference in style between someone who literally embodies the status quo and someone who really embodies the kind of change and the kind of leadership that will upend Washington, D.C. and change the economic direction of this country.
VP, Donald Trump's VP running mate, Mike Pence. Michelle Obama, First Lady, was out on the trail this week as well. That's talking with college students at LaSalle University, Pittsburgh, encouraging them not only to vote, but to vote, she said, for candidate Hillary Clinton.
Either Hillary Clinton or her opponent will be elected president this year. And if you vote for someone other than Hillary, or if you don't vote at all, then you are helping to elect her opponent. And let me just say this. The stakes are far too high to take that chance.
Beth Reinhart, we took the show out to Kent State University, and we heard that resistance among students, support for Hillary Clinton, but not in the same degree that they came out for Barack Obama, and she needs that group. What's going on there? Why isn't she bringing them in even now? Are they still stuck on Bernie Sanders or gone elsewhere?
Well, that's, you know, when she asked, why aren't I 50 points ahead, millennials are one of the reasons. And she has failed to energize them the way President Obama did. Obviously, he was a much fresher face 8 years ago. And his motto of hope and change, that sort of fit that moment. And she has struggled to find sort of a theme that captures her reason for running for office, that captures the imagination of these young people. I think, you know, what Michelle Obama said was right on point. I think there are many people who will just stay home. They're not crazy about Hillary Clinton. They're not crazy about Donald Trump. And so they just say, I'm not going to bother. And I think the Clinton folks are starting to really worry about that.
And Michelle Obama's point there, if you don't vote, if you don't participate, it's going to have a real impact. You know, and think about what that impact may be. Let's maybe hear from some of that millennial set. They're very observant about what's going on right now. Katie in Buffalo, New York. Katie, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling because I'm 32, so at the older end of the millennials. The debate swayed my husband. We were both sort of ambivalent, maybe looking for a good Republican candidate. I settled on Bernie for the primaries. And my husband decided, he's also 32, after the debate, that he couldn't deal with Trump. That Clinton was the answer. I am in New York, so a blue state. I am one of probably very few people who could say, she's going to win. I could stay home, and she could become president. I have come to the point 5 weeks before the election where I think she has to be the president, but I'd still rather not get my hands dirty.
And when you say get your hands dirty, what exactly are you looking at, Katie?
Vote for her. I'd really rather not have to be the one to vote for her. You know, I'd rather Donald Trump not be the president, but I'm still not sure I'm not going to vote third party.
Sitting in a blue state, maybe Michelle Obama's argument doesn't hit you so hard. Jack?
Well, you know, third party, Gary Johnson has gone up among millennials from he's essentially up to 29% of millennials now. He was 16%. In August, and all of that has come out of Hillary Clinton, and it is and of course Gary Johnson had a stumble this week. He couldn't name on a television interview a foreign leader he admired. I must say, though, in fairness to him, he was very well received at that. It was at a meeting of students at the University of New Hampshire. He was very well received by them. Lots of applause. And more you're hearing, well, is he, you know, people are starting to look at him. Is he a possible alternative? Well, you know, the New York Times takes that on and they say, well, people should focus on things like, well, he opposes most federal spending, including on public education. He opposes the income tax, including on the richest Americans. The libertarians, the Times said, believe health care should be handled by the private sector, goodbye Veterans Hospital, and would end Social Security. That's a lot of problematic issues for young voters to consider.
Well, and nevertheless, we see Hillary having some struggle there. Rob in Iowa City. Rob, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'm a millennial voter here in Iowa. I'm a student at the University of Iowa.
Yeah.
So early voting in Iowa started yesterday.
Wow.
And in my county alone, over 1,000 ballots were cast. And I've been volunteering with the Clinton campaign since it kicked off back in April of 2015. And despite the popular narrative that Clinton struggles with millennials, I've personally seen a lot of millennial support here in Iowa. And they have an impressive, extensive ground game going, and I expect that to put her over at the top on election night. So I encourage my fellow millennials to get out there and vote for Clinton and have them know that their vote matters, especially in a state like Iowa where it's so close.
Rob, I appreciate your call very much there from Iowa. This just cascade of newspaper endorsements this week and not looking good for Donald Trump. He mentioned the Arizona Republic. This used to be called the Arizona Republican. I mean, they have been rock-solid Republican forever. Their editorial says, since the Arizona Republic began publication in 1890, we have never endorsed a Democrat over a Republican for president, never. But this time, they're actually going all the way, endorsing Hillary Clinton. We've got the Chicago Tribune saying Republicans have nominated Donald Trump, a man not fit to be president of the United States. Also a newspaper historically very, very inclined toward Republican candidates. The USA Today
In the 34-year history of USA Today, the editorial board has never taken sides in the presidential race. Until now, they write, this year the choice is not between two capable major party nominees who happen to have significant ideological differences. Donald Trump, USA Today writing, is by unanimous consensus of the editorial board unfit for the presidency. And to your point on Gary Johnson, the Detroit News, Jack, saying today, this newspaper does something it has never done in its 143-year history, endorse someone other than the Republican candidate in a presidential contest. They're going for Gary Johnson. Beth, do these endorsements by newspapers still matter in the year 2016?
I'm not sure that they matter a lot, but it certainly speaks to the mounting almost panic that I think the political establishment is feeling, looking at the polls being as close as they are. One that you didn't mention was Dorothy Rabinowitz, a member of the Wall Street Journal editorial page,
which is very conservative.
Obviously very conservative, wrote a column that's headlined Hillary Hatred Derangement Syndrome. And, you know, she talks about, sure, Hillary Clinton has these shortcomings and foibles, but she's sane. That's one of the arguments that she makes. And I think
did she go all the way to support Hillary or just say no to Trump? Or where did Rabinowitz come down?
Yeah, yeah. She's saying it's that she's a much better choice than and that going to what some of these other editorials are saying, that Donald Trump is simply unfit to be president.
That's amazing. Dorothy Rabinowitz. Yeah. I mean, talk about a Republican. Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay.
Donald Trump's campaign has been built on the idea that he would make America strong because he is a strong leader, but all he's done this week is prove the opposite, how incredibly weak he is as an individual. At the Democratic convention, Hillary Clinton told everybody that he was easily baited. She gave him warning she was going to do it. She called her shot, and then she did it at the debate. She baited him, and because he is psychologically incapable, as Jack said, of letting the slightest little hit go by, he took the bait, and he continues to take the bait. At 5 o'clock this morning, he sent out this Twitter storm continuing to attack Alicia Machado. The point is that if he were president of the United States, he would be easily manipulated. He would make the United States easily manipulated. He would make us far weaker because of his own narcissism and his own incredible weak-mindedness.
Mark, you may be right. I mean, there's your opinion, but a lot of Americans, look at the polls, are lined up with Donald Trump. What do you say to that? What do you make of it?
The electorate has been polarized for years into Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives. I don't think it's possible for a Republican to get less than about 45% of the vote in an election.
We've got a bunch of Republicans saying no to him. All these Republican newspapers saying no. Dorothy Rabinowitz, even the Wall Street Journal op-ed page. Are you kidding me? That's Republican as it gets saying no.
That's the Republican establishment. What the Republican establishment failed to realize for the past 40 years is that they have been creating a base by their assiduous cultivation of the alt-right that is increasingly divorced from conservative ideology. The establishment is all about conservative ideology. The base is not. They've created a monster. It's got nothing to do with conservative principles. Trump has routinely abandoned virtually every conservative principle, and they don't care in the base because the secret of Trump's success is very simple. He hates the same people they hate.
Mark, I appreciate your call. What a year. I mean, the Detroit News, which has never not endorsed a Republican, calling Donald Trump unprincipled, unstable, and quite possibly dangerous, writing he cannot be president. Nancy in Dayton, Ohio. You're on the air, Nancy.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I wanted to say that it just seems to me for the last 20 years that Hillary has been up against Fox Nation and that whole media complex, and she's, you know, it everywhere that Fox News is she is the enemy, and so I kind of think that she can't that free radio and free television that Donald Trump is getting from constantly going on the air with them and never talking really to any other news organizations. That's where he's like getting his points and getting billions and billions of dollars worth of free advertising.
Nancy, I appreciate your call. I mean, I have to say, it's not only Fox News that has paid a lot of attention to Donald Trump, of course, over the course of this campaign. We're looking at a week in the news. We'll get beyond the campaign, but it is big this week. Election Day is coming. Michael Crowley, we've got to look abroad for a second here. The bombs raining down on Aleppo in the last week and more now have caught the attention of the world. Big attacks by Washington, rhetorically anyway, on Russia for being right there with the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad in dropping bunker buster bombs and incendiary munitions and cluster bombs and all of it, we're told. I want you to give us your read on this. This is U.N. Ambassador, U.S. U.N. Ambassador Samantha Power last weekend. Harsh words for the Russian and Syrian governments at the U.N. Security Council.
Russia will argue today, no doubt, that these attacks are meant to fight terrorism and that the people killed in this offensive are terrorists or terrorist sympathizers. This is absurd. What you can be sure that Russia will not do is tell the truth. What Russia is sponsoring and doing is not counterterrorism. It is barbarism. It is apocalyptic, what is being done to eastern Aleppo.
The U.S. U.N. ambassador there, the British ambassador there, calling it war crimes. Ban Ki-moon, Secretary General, war crimes. Michael Crowley, on the other hand, it just goes on. Does the U.S. have any leverage over this? Does the international community?
Not much, Tom. And you didn't mention my, I guess I would say, favorite quote, although favorite seems like a strange word to use in this context. But a senior UN official said yesterday that Aleppo is descending into, quote, a merciless abyss of humanitarian catastrophe. Yeah. So, catastrophe, apocalypse, whatever you want to call it. And yes, this is happening, to answer your question, because I think that the U.S. and its allies have very little leverage. And this is of great frustration, for instance, to Secretary of State John Kerry, who has been ridiculed for negotiating endlessly with the Russians to try to reach these ceasefire deals, to try to get us moving toward a political solution. You know, in fact, Kerry has advocated repeatedly for some stronger U.S. intervention, including potentially hitting Syrian regime forces so that we have leverage to force some kind of change in the negotiating posture of the Russians and the Syrians. And the view of people like Kerry and his sympathizers is that you're not going to get anything done as long as the Russians and the Syrians, with the help of the Iranians, essentially have the military muscle on the ground, and that Bashar Assad doesn't feel like his grip on power is threatened. He's not going to come to the negotiating table and make concessions as long as we have. Maybe it's a stalemate. It doesn't look like his forces are going to be able to completely take back the country, but he's in a position to have the key population centers and be relatively happy with what he's got, at least in the near term.
So is it fair, Michael, for Donald Trump to point at this and say, weak?
Well, is it fair? I mean, Tom, we could do 2 hours on that question. Let me just say for those who want to make the argument that this is weakness, they would say we need to stick our necks out a little more and get that leverage that I just mentioned. We need to create facts on the ground that give us leverage at a negotiating table that we want to bring the Russians and Assad to. I think the response to that is, okay, fine. How much risk are you willing to take as a president? How much are you willing to invest in terms of money and treasure and potentially American blood to make that happen? Because the danger is that if we escalate, the Russians and the Iranians escalate, we start getting dragged in. President Obama has talked about, I don't know if he's used the exact words, but he clearly sees it as a slippery slope situation. We start doing this stuff, then our credibility and pride is on the line. Then everyone's pressuring him. Well, your first strikes didn't work. You got to do more strikes. Then the Russians are hitting back. We've already seen some close calls where Russian or Syrian bombs have nearly hit American forces. What happens if one side – we accidentally bombed some Syrian forces a few days ago, it looks like. Mm-hmm. What happens if one side hits some guys on the other side and things spiral out of control really fast? So, stronger, tougher, fine, but you're incurring a lot more risk by doing that. And this president is not willing to take that risk – A, and B, his time in office is winding down, and I think he's probably not ready to launch a big new policy change. Although briefly, the last thing I'll say is there is a conversation happening at the White House, allegedly, I don't know how real it is or whether it's to get the Russians to move, about sending bigger arms to the Syrian rebels that could make some changes on the ground, but I'm skeptical it'll happen.
Arms like anti-aircraft? Are we talking Stinger missiles or just anti-aircraft or something in that order?
Anti-aircraft that are less mobile than Stinger missiles, maybe, so that they can't move around and proliferate and hopefully not shoot down a civilian airliner.
Or an American airliner, American fighter. Michael Crowley with Politico. It's terrific to have you with us today. Please stand by there in Washington. Beth Reinhart with The Wall Street Journal. Jack Beatty, we're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. In other news this week on The Late Show, Stephen Colbert joked about the different expectations for the two candidates for the presidency. For Hillary to win, she had to be confident but not smug, he said, knowledgeable without being a know-it-all.
Charming but not affected, commanding but not shrill. Also, likable, warm, authoritative, and not coughing. Meanwhile, Donald Trump had to not commit murder. On camera.
Okay. A video from North Carolina went viral of Ziana Oliphant, a young girl with tears running down her face, distressed about the shootings of African Americans. She spoke at Charlotte's first city council meeting since the police shooting of Keith Lamont Scott.
We are black people and we shouldn't have to feel like this. We shouldn't have to protest because y'all are treating us wrong. We do this because we need to and have rights.
Well, and golf legend Arnold Palmer, dead this week at 87, he played his first Masters, his final Masters game in 2004, and deeply loved the game.
I thank God for the game of golf and what it has meant to me.
Arnold Palmer, what a figure. We're looking at a week in the news, the first debate, Trump, Clinton, millennials, Aleppo bleeding the train in Hoboken, Israel's Shimon Peres is dead, peace champion there. With Beth Reinhart, political reporter for The Wall Street Journal, Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, Jack Beatty is here. You can join us. We're looking at this campaign, have to, debate, election day is coming up, looking at Syria, Russia, Aleppo, the U.S. Final thoughts on Shimon Peres today, and can you believe the toll of destruction from that train crash in Hoboken? Jackie in Austin, Texas. Jackie, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm the mother of two millennials, and so I'd like to remind all the millennials out there that, in fact, the presidential candidates can say anything during the election preseason, but, in fact, it's Congress that determines how much of whatever their agenda is actually gets passed. And with respect to Gary Johnson is a libertarian. That is a theory that has never been tested in any government that I know of. So to convert our government, which is a democracy, to the libertarian philosophy would take years. And Congress would sufficiently block a lot of what he wants to do because libertarianism is not.
But Jackie, what do you say to millennials who say, and this is what the line that I hear from them again and again, we don't trust Hillary Clinton.
Okay, I say this. I say that Hillary Clinton has been scrutinized for 30-some years. If she gets elected into office, Congress will be on her like a pig in a truffle hunt, and she will be checked and scrutinized constantly. So whatever you're worried about, they'll be watching her. Donald Trump, on the other hand, while Congress can block any crazy policies that are unconstitutional or illegal, they will not be able to stop what comes out of his mouth because clearly his closest family, friends, advisors, whatever, are incapable of doing that. And that is the greatest danger for our country. And this is why everybody needs to go out and vote. I personally am holding my nose to vote for Hillary Clinton because it's politics as usual, and I hoped for a change. But she is, I agree with every other Republican, the Arizona Republic, the Wall Street Journal columnist, Jennifer, who wrote the editorial yesterday. Dorothy. She is the only sane choice, and we have Congress and we have a Supreme Court that will check on her and her policies.
Jackie, I appreciate your call very much from Austin, Texas. Beth Reinhart, speaking of scrutiny, we still have the situation this week, and it is such a short time to the election now, where Donald Trump has not put out his tax returns. Every president for, 40 years has done this. He's a businessman, and that's one of his central claims to legitimacy or to, you know, to his run for the presidency. How can it be that he is not willing to subject himself to that kind of transparent scrutiny that every other major candidate has done for 40 years? How can it, and is it hurting him, Beth, or not?
Donald Trump doesn't play by the rules. I mean, he's shown that again and again and again, and this is obviously a big one. I don't think it's an issue that really motivates voters, though. It has resulted in a lot of reporting, tough reporting on his foundation, for example, how he has, questions about whether he's given as much to charity as he claims to have given. These are questions that would be resolved by releasing his tax returns. It allows Hillary Clinton in the debate to suggest, probably incorrectly, that he's never paid federal income taxes. We know that he has in at least 3 years that we have records for. So it does leave a lot of questions hanging, but I don't think this is the question that is going to, ultimately, bring him down.
I guess not, but you would think that people would want that kind of transparency in somebody for the highest office in the land. And if they don't care about it, then there's something really bugging people that's making them willing to overlook that. Is that what's going on here? I don't know. Let's go to Andrew, Jamestown, New York. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm okay. What do you see, Andrew?
Good. It's about the election. I drive probably close to 700 miles a week, and I'm a 23-year-old, I guess you can call it millennial.
What are you? Are you a truck driver? What do you do, Andrew?
Yeah, I deliver stuff. I'm
okay,
a truck
great.
Driver.
Yeah.
And I've seen nothing but Trump and Mike Pence signs. I travel through Western New York.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen one Hillary Clinton sign, and I'm a Trump supporter myself. So it's amazing to me to see all these people come on and not one person for Trump.
What is it about Trump that draws your vote? And what about the taxes? Do you want him to show what every other candidate has shown, Andrew, or you don't care?
Well, the taxes, I could pretty much tell you. The reason he doesn't want to is because a lot of people will be upset. He buys and sells things a lot, and because it's a business, he probably writes a lot of it off. So he doesn't want to. So he doesn't pay a whole lot in taxes, probably, because it's all coming back to him.
You don't care about that? That doesn't matter to you?
Oh no, my biggest thing is Hillary with the emails. Why would the whole 33,000 being deleted? She doesn't know that the letter C stood for confidential. The fact that the whole Benghazi thing, and she left Americans over there to die. The fact that people want her and they can't see through all of her lies, that bugs me the most. And like I said, I'm only 23 years old.
But, I mean, Andrew, Benghazi, I get it, but she's been, 11 hours of testimony before Congress. I mean, is that really the test of character that you're going to judge everything on?
Yeah, for me, I mean, the Benghazi and the emails, I mean, yes, the director even said, the director of the FBI, Comey, he even said that, yes, they were classified. And I have information that she deleted. Yes, it was marked
classified. Well, I mean, Andrew, I don't know about your information. I mean, Comey was out there this week defending allegations of negligence and dishonesty in the handling of this investigation over Hillary Clinton's emails. And he said, look, we investigated them absolutely thoroughly. Here was the FBI director.
You can call us wrong, but don't call us weasels. We are not weasels. We are honest people. And we did this in that way. Whether you disagree or agree with the result, this was done the way you would want it to be done.
Jack Beatty, there's Andrew, 23 years old, and you hear what he sees and where he's headed with his vote.
Yes, and it has been one of the surprises of this campaign that Hillary Clinton, at least in one poll, is seen as, by 10% more Americans, is seen as less trustworthy than Donald Trump. I say that's a surprise because in the course of the campaign, as PolitiFact and other groups have pointed out, about half, perhaps a little more than half, of Mr. Trump's statements have not just been wrong, but they've been pants on fire wrong. Whereas with Mrs. Clinton, I think
people
are
using the word lie in this campaign, Jack, which
is
seldom said.
Yes, lie, yes. And we saw some of that. We saw many lies. I've seen five or six or seven people talking about in the debate. For example, I was against the Iraq war. He wasn't. In real time, it's clear. But he lies about it. And that should matter to people. It really should. And my point was, Hillary has also got problems. But, you know, these same objective measures of fact say she's in about, you know, 10% or 12% of her comments are, quote, lies.
Speaking of lies, let's take it abroad again. We got you here, Michael Crowley, and I'm very glad for that. We had this Dutch-led investigation that came out this week on Wednesday saying after a long investigation that they believed indeed it was a Russian missile that downed a passenger jet over Ukraine in 2014. We all remember that, killing 298 people. Here was a mother, Selena Friedrichs, a mother of one of the victims, talking to the press after that announcement.
Well, we have seen a lot of information in the media the last 26 months, and that what we thought might be the truth has been confirmed.
Michael Crowley, is Moscow now conceding that it was a Russian missile that took down the Malaysian airliner?
Tom, Moscow doesn't concede much, and on this point, I think they will never concede, at least not in my lifetime. Moscow says the investigation was rigged, ignored contrary evidence. There are a lot of, you know, alternate theories propagated by the Russians and the pro-Russian separatists in Ukraine. Among them, this was, the Ukrainians themselves shot this plane down. Russia had nothing to do with it. There's all kinds of doctored evidence being used. So no, Moscow is not accepting this. And by the way, although he said it last fall, I didn't see it until it appeared on Twitter last night. And it really made my head spin a little bit. Donald Trump has questioned whether this was a Russian missile and whether the accepted in the West theory of what happened is accurate. He did that back in, I think, September, so people can look that up. I found that exceedingly strange given, or maybe not strange, given all the other things he said about Russia and his complimentary words for Vladimir Putin and questioning whether Russia really annexed Ukraine and so on and so forth. But on the investigation, no, Russia does not accept the evidence, but it seems to me that we now have a very strong empirical basis, and these Dutch prosecutors seem ready to press on and pretty soon potentially even name names of people in the chain of command who gave the order.
Michael, is this another reason people are interested in Donald Trump's taxes? Because they might reveal Russian investors' investments? Yes. That he's made a lot of very friendly comments about Russian leaders.
He has. Your listeners are probably familiar with this. You know, he said kind things about Vladimir Putin, who has also complimented him. He's questioned the NATO alliance, which Putin does all the time. He's kind of challenged Western rhetoric about Ukraine in ways that echo what the Kremlin has said. And there is a lot of suspicion that this might be driven by business interests. As you say, would his tax returns reveal that he has undisclosed investments or debts or other business ties to Russia? We know just from the public record, and this is something I've written about, that he's done some business with very wealthy Russians. He seems to know a lot of very wealthy Russians in Manhattan. So is this part of, this kind of softer line he's been taking toward Moscow? Is it a kind of, he's frequently sought to do business deals to real estate development projects in Moscow. So does he have an eye on this? There's a school of thought that says, he may not want to be alienating Russia if he loses this campaign. He wants to be welcome there if he makes another push to do business in Moscow or simply to do business with these many, many very wealthy Russians that are in Manhattan and all over the world buying extremely high-end real estate. And so his tax returns could shed some light on that.
Michael, may I ask you to turn this to the override this week of the president's veto of legislation that would allow Americans to sue Saudi Arabia over the attacks of September 11th, 2001. Can you explain two things? First, why was the president so adamantly opposed to this legislation? And why were the Senate and House so overwhelmingly, even Democrats, in spite of the president's opposition, drawn toward it?
So on the first point, let me just note that it's ironic because President Obama has emerged as one of the kind of bigger critics of Saudi Arabia in Washington, although he has done things to maintain the fundamental U.S. alliance with the Saudis, which is important, though complicated. He does complain more than many of his predecessors about things that drive him crazy about the Saudis and their foreign policy. And here he's in the position of being this defender of the Saudis. But really, I think he's in arguing against this legislation, he's not defending Saudi Arabia so much as United States and its interests. He's joined by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Defense Secretary, the CIA Director, all of them saying that there could be unintended consequences from this legislation.
Like what?
That would allow what it would do is set a precedent where we're saying that you can sue a foreign country and disregard what we call sovereign immunity. The United States would, if this was to become a practice around the world, we would become the number one target around the world. If we sort of eroded
for everybody
this
suing
standard,
you
where mm-hmm. everyone is coming after us, right? And so we have we're in legal jeopardy for all kinds of things that we do abroad. And so the U.S. National Security Establishment was very concerned about this. On the other question, you know, why did this pass so overwhelmingly? I think it's as simple as this. You know, who can say no to the victims of these families? Partly, I think it was kind of a ridiculous vote, and we're seeing already members of Congress are backpedaling. There was a letter signed by 30 senators saying, hey, is there a way we can maybe take another swipe at this and modify it? The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is complaining that the White House didn't educate Congress well enough and that indeed, you know, maybe this wasn't such a great step to take. I think in reality, this was cynical, and these guys knew as a political proposition. You know, how can you say no to the victims, to the survivors of 9/11 victims? And also on a human level, there was a lot of lobbying in the halls of Congress. There probably was a real emotional driver for these members. Yeah. But at the end of the day, I think it will probably be watered down. We're already starting to see those gears turn. So not Congress's
Got
finest
it.
Hour, I would say.
Got it. Jack Beatty, final thoughts on Shimon Peres. He stood up for peace for a long time, became more and more lonely in that capacity in Israel before his death at 93 this week.
Yes, and he taught, you know, his life was the history of the state. You know, the great days, David Ben-Gurion, the building of the defense establishment, the reaching out to the Palestinians. And yet, you know, in his funeral, there was a handshake between the Israeli prime minister and the Palestinian president. And it was the first time in 5 years, and it felt like there's not going to be another one of these for a long time.
Shimon Peres, dead at 93 this week, who spoke up again and again for peace, even when that became a rare kind of statement among Israeli leadership, and he was finding less and less support among the Israeli people. But a big one, who was there at the White House for the Oslo Peace Accords all the way back in Bill Clinton's day. Beth Reinhart with the Wall Street Journal, thank you so much for being with us today, Beth. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Crowley at Politico, senior foreign affairs correspondent. Thank you, Michael.
It's a pleasure, Tom. Thanks.
And Jack Beatty, thanks as always. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.